Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
On Formative, middle school kids from New York City public schools interview a phenomenal collection of grown-ups.
Me, like, I don't know what I want to do.
You don't have to have all the answers.
I feel like a lot of people's favorite topics are, like, interest in their life.
That is a really good answer.
The podcast where the leaders of today are interviewed by leaders of tomorrow. Listen now at newyorkedge.org/formative or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f***?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another Rahalastapa. This one has been fast-tracked. We recorded it last Wednesday. It's with Bill Burr. Really interesting and long chat, despite it being his birthday and him having a week-old child. Rescheduled because he was having a baby the week before. But I really enjoyed it. I hope you will too. Bill was very keen to crack on with the podcast. I did explain I was meant to do a bit of stand-up at the start, but he sort of jumped all over it. So I'll tell you what I was going to say. I sort of slightly allude to it, but... I'd come up with the Colston statue going into the drink in Bristol was a cause of great celebration for me. I'm a local boy, and it's always been a sort of horrible little stain over the city that so much is named after Colston, and it's been so difficult to get things changed. So I think it was a lovely thing to see People Power in operation and just targeting one act of vandalism, admittedly, but against... Unless you're pro slave trading, then you know we've got to take into account all viewpoints in this world, right, and accept them. But if you're pro slave trading or think that there's not a problem with having a statue of a slave trader in a multicultural society, then you know, have a look at yourselves and don't get upset about that and nothing else. You know, maybe it'll go too far. Who knows? Maybe they'll take down every statue in the world. But I think that was a good call. But I did come up with the idea of having the statue put back and then a new statue made with the protesters pulling it down. So it would satisfy everyone that Colston would still be there, covered in paint and pulled down. But it would also commemorate a great day, I think, in Bristol's history. Bristol needed to do this. I think maybe just... My local understanding of the place makes it more poignant for me, but maybe not. Then the next day after I tweeted that, Banksy tweeted it and got on CNN and everything. And it's annoying, he ripped me off. Old Banksy, Ian Banksy. He's already got all the banks. Why does he need to rip me off as well? So I was going to talk about that. I think we briefly did mention that to the right at the start of the podcast. I was going to talk about the fact that I think my kids are coping quite well psychologically with lockdown. You know, they aren't seeing other kids very much. My daughter's actually just gone back to school, so that's nice. But my son hasn't really seen any other kids apart from just passing in the street for a long time. I don't think it's psychologically damaged him. The other day we were playing in the garden with the sprinkler. They were running in and out of the sprinkler. And my son kept on calling the sprinkler his best friend. He said, my best friend got me wet. So I don't think it's psychologically damaged him. I've been helping them to eat their food. You know, people do the aeroplane thing. I thought it was a bit boring. So I kind of improved quite a few of ideas, like a lift, that like a great glass elevator that could go anywhere and arrived at its place, a football match where it goes into the goal. The final thing I came up with, the one that still worked, they loved it. And the one that really worked is I pretend to be like an elephant or a brontosaurus doing a poo and I can't find anywhere to poo. And then I poo in their mouth and they go, oh, you've eaten the poo. I can't see that's going to lead to any psychological damage. But my kids don't appreciate what they're getting. That's what I'm saying. You know, I'm providing this bang on, fantastic improvised stand-up comedy. They just think all dads are as brilliant as me, and they're not. They'll learn. They'll find out one day how. Just because I beat them and make them friends with sprinklers. I don't beat them. I don't. No, don't hit your kids. Come on. Grow up. So anyway, yeah, so I didn't get a chance, which is good, because we don't want to repeat ourselves. But if you're enjoying these live streams, live streamed Rahulastapas, we're doing them every Wednesday night on twitch.tv/rkherring. There's lots of other stuff going on that channel, including stone clearing, snooker, very exciting snooker tournament. On Sunday nights, we occasionally do I've done one with Katie, my wife, director's commentary of a film that we're not involved with. Hopefully we'll keep on doing those every now and again. And I want to start, once I've got my book out of the way, I want to start trying to find some other exciting ways to use the Twitch channel. twitch.tv/rkherring. If you're with Amazon Prime, you can give me £5 every single month at no cost to yourself. If you go to Herring 1967 on YouTube and look in the video section, it's the second or third layer down, you'll find it. All the instructions of how to do that. It's slightly complicated. You have to remember to go back every month, but we'll channel that money back into making more podcasts. Or you can become a monthly badger and get your fantastic I'm One of the Cool Kids packs with two badges, a membership card, all sorts of secret codes. That's my son trying to join in the podcast. Hope you're enjoying that. Plus access to all the backstage videos, lots more there. So your support would be appreciated. We're going to put it all back together into trying to, once we're filming the Rahulastapas live, which we might live stream as well. And we're making a audio sitcom when I can get around to writing that. And we'll try and provide you with loads more content for all the money that you are providing us with. So thank you very much for your support in these difficult times. GoFasterStrike.com has some great things. You can buy the books and the chop chops and downloads. You know the stuff I'm talking about. So I was going to talk about single people can spend a night with a loved one as of what will be for you last Saturday, and just talk about it being a fuck fest. But it is a loved one, so be careful, because if you go around spending time with someone, they will think you're in love with them. So just be careful. I'm not jealous of you. I've been having sex all through the lockdown, often with myself, but sometimes with a human being. Got married. Bad luck, losers. Should have got married, and then you could have had occasional sex as well. Boop, boop. Okay, let's crack on. I hope to sit back and enjoy this fabulous podcast with the multi-talented and very impressive William Burr. Hello, welcome to another live-streamed podcast. This is Richard Herring's Lamenting Slave Traders podcast. Too many people are on the slave trade, up against the slave traders, and I think it's time to feel sad for them having their statues thrown into water. Mate, we'll give it a go, see how that goes.
What's the overhead with all of those boats?
I was talking to Banksy the other day. He's come up with an idea for a podcast. It's called Rahulastapa. So you can hear my guest is already there. So I might just go straight to him. Banksy ripped off my idea, basically. He's probably best known. Here he is as Fitzy in Two Guys, a Girl and a Pizza Place. Here he is. Will you please welcome Bill Burr? There he is, Fitzy. We all know him as Fitzy.
from.
Oh, wait, sorry, I didn't know I wasn't supposed to talk. In
no,
the
no,
intro.
It's okay. We've
like
come
I
in.
Messed it up.
We've come in a bit last minute, so that's all cool. No, we've had some fun in the UK in Bristol, where I'm near. We're near to where I'm from, where people have pulled. Have you seen this news? People have pulled down the statue of a guy who made his money slave trading and thrown it in the harbour. It's a delightful story. But I came up with the idea. Some people are cross that the slave traders' statue has been torn down in the UK. I came up with an idea they should get out of the harbour and then make a statue of it being pulled down by protesters. And then Banksy came up with that idea the next day, the artist, and he's all over the newspapers with that idea. So I'm annoyed that he's ripped me off accidentally, I'm sure. Anyway, how are you, Bill? Are you okay?
I'm doing great. Yeah. I'm doing great.
Happy birthday. 52 today.
Thank you.
Now we're the same age.
52 years old. Yeah. Still not taking a day off from show business. Look at me. Still promoting.
It's incredible.
Still a big Hollywood phony.
And more impressively, you've got a 6 or 7 day old baby as well, and you're still promoting. So that is the reason we didn't get you last week, was because you were rushing to hospital.
Yep, he's a week old.
Wow.
Old champ.
How are you sleeping? Are you getting any sleep?
You know, in 2 hour pockets. it is, but this is the second time around, so I don't know. I just knew that my life was going to be a certain way until like September, hopefully. But the kid isn't colicky or anything like that. He's sure. A champ, you know. He gets milk drunk. He passes out, so it's good. So I got to do is wake up, change the diaper, hand him to my wife, and then, you know. But we also have a little bit of help here, too. My mother-in-law is right down the street. So.
Oh, that's nice. That's good. Well, you know, I've got two young kids as well, which is one of our many similarities, and I was up at 2:30 last night and didn't really get much sleep. So we might just work in a little nap halfway through the podcast. We can both have a little nap and it'll be fine.
All right.
There are some similarities. I'm 11 months older than you. We both got into stand-up in the early 90s. Had a bit of stuff on TV, but it wasn't until we both got into podcasting. You were about 5 or 6 months before me in podcasting. I've been podcasting since January 2008, and you were, I think, June maybe 2007. As a result of that, things have come to...
I like how you're saying maybe, and you're 100% accurate in all of your research. I don't know, we're going to say maybe June 2007.
It's just from memory, so I might have got it wrong. You've got two, we've both had kids late in life. I've got a 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. You've got a 3-year-old and a 0-year-old, is that right? And
yep.
Boy and a girl and a boy, so exactly the same. And you've been on Breaking Bad, and I've been on Pointless Celebrities. So it's exactly the same.
Parallel universe.
It is.
I'm glad we finally met.
It's incredible. You are the American me with a bit more success. Do you remember being Fitzy and Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza Place? That's what I'm most interested in. I'm going to talk about that.
Yes,
for probably
I did.
45 minutes.
Yes, I did. I did that, and I remember. Thinking that that was all one part, or that I was going to get to play the role of Bernie, because
right.
Bernie had more lines. And then it turned out I actually played Ann Fitz, and my lines were just like awesome, huge. And this is the thing: I sucked at it. I wasn't funny. Like I didn't know how to. I wasn't a good actor back then. But that's probably why I had 3 lines, 3 words. So I do remember. The star of the show, Ryan
Reynolds, is it?
He's gone on to be like the biggest star ever.
Ryan Reynolds?
Come on. Ryan Reynolds, yeah. I remember being blown away by his confidence.
Right.
And he was like a 20, 21-year-old kid. And I just thought that he just had that star power thing.
Sure.
And everybody on the show was like really cool. And it was kind of exciting in that later became Two Guys and a Girl, and then but it went on to become like, you know, a syndicated hit. And I think I was in the pilot,
right?
So just being a nerd of show business, it was a lot of fun to be like, oh wow, they all made it and they got syndication money back when there was syndication money. So I was very happy with everybody, all of them. Trailer Howard, I'm trying to remember all the names, but they were all cool.
Cool. Well, that's good. I take a bit of a punt with that. It didn't make it over to the UK, that particular sitcom. So
God, you guys, you're so uncultured out there. How do you sit back from Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza Place?
Well, look it up. It must be online.
You guys could have smoothed over that whole Brexit thing. You could have got on the same page, all just sitting there watching that show.
As long as there's no blackface in it, everything with blackface in it has today been cancelled in the UK. So as long as no one blacked up in it, then we can watch it. It might be filling the schedules. There's a lot of UK shows with blackface in them. Surprisingly,
amazing
recently.
To me that white people still do that and then are astounded by the backlash. It's like, even if you think there's nothing wrong with it, it's like, don't be astounded by a backlash, because it's just, yeah. You haven't noticed the last 900 people having their careers ended immediately when they did it. You would think no matter how racist you are, you'd at least be intelligent enough to not shoot yourself in the foot and maybe just keep that for your own private Eyes Wide Shut party at home. You'd think they would do that, right? Nope.
It's weird. Well, I mean, there was a period between like 2002 and 2010. Well, I think everyone, maybe in the UK, thought the problem had gone away and it was all right to go back to. I remember thinking when I saw those things, this is pretty weird. But there was a surprising amount of it. I know there's a few people in America who've, I think Jimmy Kimmel's recently just, they've dug up some old sketch of that. But it happened a lot. There was a show in the UK in the 70s.
That's my favorite thing. I love when they dig something up and everybody that was alive when it happened. And didn't voice being offended 15 years later gets to be retroactive. I'm talking about the white people.
Yeah.
They get retroactively. I know black people were immediately offended, but the white people are going to be like, and then this happened in 1998. It's like, aren't you like 35? I think at what point did you finally wake up and realize that maybe that was something you didn't want to do? So I think that's, I don't know. There's a big thing now with white people over here. Throwing other white people under the bus, under the guise that they care about black people. But I always wonder, there's a little bit of like, yeah, put it on him and keep it off of me.
Sure.
You know, it's like all the woke hiring that's being done now in Hollywood. It's like, and they're all acting like they got rid of the white people that weren't hiring people of color. It's like, you're the same people. You just got called out on it. And now you're acting like, you know, the old way of doing it. Oh, you mean the way you were doing it 5 years ago? The fuck out of here.
Well, I think there's a lot of truth in that. It's interesting with your stand-up, because obviously you're expressing quite a lot of views that are against that kind of liberal consensus that a lot of stand-ups prescribe.
I am liberal.
Pardon?
But I am liberal.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm not
exactly.
Like, I'm not a liberal that is like so far to that side that you sort of starting to become, you know, other than your ideologies, the way you handle differences of opinion is no different than the far right.
Yeah, sure.
It got a little crazy over here. It got a little crazy over here where it just was just, if somebody said something, that means you did it. And then your entire ability to earn a living was then going to be taken away unless you weren't good at it.
Yeah.
If you weren't good at it, then it was okay to continue on. Because there were certain comedians that were good at being comedians and people were like, I don't think you should ever be a comedian again. Then there was other people who got busted and then started to pick up the pieces by becoming comedians. But because they sucked and no one was going to their shows, nobody had a problem with it. So none of it made sense. It was just a lot of headless running around.
But with a comedian, I think it's wrong to sort of prescribe any idea, any purpose to it, because you can do whatever you want with comedy, but it's part of comedy's job to see the bad on both sides, to pick apart bad arguments, to pick apart things that are ludicrous. So I think the minute a comedian becomes too entrenched in a political view, it's then are quite difficult. I think if you are a liberal,
I think at that point is when you move on to having your own talk show. You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. But I think also, you know, as you say, I think you can see I'm sure some people can't see the irony in some of the routines, but you can see you're very playful with it, so you'll take things to a ridiculous extreme that therefore shows that you don't really mean it. You're playing around with the ideas, which again is what.
Well, I understand that how much information is out there and how much is actually between my ears, which is a big difference.
Yeah.
So you can't take yourself too seriously. And if you kind of like shit on both sides, then everybody can kind of just, you know, laugh at themselves and hopefully, I don't know what, be a little more, I don't know, not as offended at the end of the show.
Sure.
It's so stupid. People getting offended. Like the amount of stuff that you can truly get, the amount of stuff that's truly happening. But it's, a lot of the really bad stuff has advertising money behind it. So no one wants to really address that. So I think comedians, in a way, are just sitting ducks, where it's just like, that's, you're going to take all of your, get what the oil companies and the bankers and the corporations, forget all of that stuff. Did you hear the Caitlyn Jenner joke this guy did?
Yeah.
You know, it's just, I just, we're soft targets, I think.
Yeah. But I think also in your routines, in your specials, the big thing is you sort of aren't saying you know. I think what's you'll do a big rant about something and go, I don't know, though. I don't know. And so I think like that.
Because I don't.
Yeah, exactly.
Because I don't, Richard. I don't. I'm just saying what I think is right. Yeah. But I can be swayed. You know, anybody listening, you don't need to yell at me. I can be swayed. If you make good points and I realize that I, you know. I've read a lot, but they've been like autobiographies of sports heroes.
Sure.
So that doesn't really, that's not really the best thing when you start commenting on the ills of society, I guess.
And comedy should be a place where you can question things, and it should be a place that is a, you know, it should ironically be a slightly safe space in the sense that you should be allowed to say what you want. And if you're wrong, then, you know, as a comedian, you know the audience, if you fuck it
up,
the audience.
You can say what you want as long as it's what they want to hear, yeah, is how it's become.
Yeah.
That's progressive thought right now. It's really stupid. And it's also like the level of power that it's been given is, it's like, it's crazy. Like, there was a legit time over here for about 18 months that comics were walking around worried about getting in trouble. It's like, with who? Like, how many people are really like, you know, it only takes like, I kind of learned with my podcast network, if we all tweeted at the same time, if 40 of us tweeted at the same time, you could get something going. So it's not a good read of like, and I saw something like on Twitter where it was just like, you know, like 2% of the people on Twitter created like 60% of the content or something like that. So it's really not a good, it was like say 15% of the American population was on Twitter, and then 2% of that 15% created like this really high percentage of the content. So
sure,
everybody else is just sort of, you know, just watching it.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's who cares? Who cares?
I know. Well, it is crazy as well. Let's talk about the new projects that I've seen. The King of Staten Island, which I saw a couple of weeks ago, which I think is out now. Is it? It's streaming. Friday.
It starts streaming Friday over here.
Okay, so it's a film Judd Apatow directing and Pete Davidson, who's from Saturday Night Live. Which again, maybe in the UK people aren't quite as familiar with Saturday Night Live, but I think they will know who Pete is.
It's a sketch show that came out about 5 years after Monty Python.
Yeah, and it's still going.
Just to give you a frame of it, it's been around since 1975, and it's launched a lot of major careers.
No, well, it's now on Sky, and we watch it all the time. It's an interesting show. It's obviously launched a lot of big names. But you play.
I hope nobody ever describes one of my stand-up specials as interesting. Your special. It was interesting.
Well, but with a stand-up show,
it made me rub my chin a little bit.
You don't do a stand-up show in a week and put it out on TV. And if you did, it would be interesting, Bill, I think. It's hit and miss. Okay, I was going to say it's hit and miss, but all comedy and all stand, especially sketch shows, are always hit and miss. But it's
everything is hit or miss.
Yeah,
you go into a bar, you talk to some birds, as you guys say over there. It's hit or miss. Hit or miss.
Yeah. But the film is...
wait a minute. Is that a urine sample? I heard if you drink your own urine, that's how you keep your hair. Is that what you're doing?
It's a non-alcoholic beer I'm trying. I'm kind of skirting around not drinking and then drinking. I drank last night, so I'm having non-alcoholic beer. It's all right.
Oh, God bless you.
Thank you.
Everything in moderation.
Right? So you...
I haven't drank since November 24th, 2018, and I'm miserable.
Oh, really? I gave up for a year, 13 months, about the same time as... We live parallel lives. I gave up until just before the coronavirus hit. And then I'm glad I drank. I drank pretty much through the first 2 months of the coronavirus, and then thought I'm going to stop a bit again because it was a bit too much.
I remember actually being happy that I wasn't drinking because I would have gone through some bottles during that. But I actually dream about drinking. I had a dream last night that I had a drink. And it wasn't even taste good. I was more thinking like, oh, I ended my streak of days. That's all I really thought. But
I've had that dream. I've had that dream.
I could use a beer and a shot like you read about.
Why? What made you stop drinking?
My kid.
Yeah.
I would be downstairs legally shit-faced thinking like, God forbid my daughter had a problem. And then I'm going to be drunk dad who has to Uber to a hospital. The big mistake I made was I brought it home.
Yeah.
For most of my adult life, if I wanted to have a drink, I had to go out to a bar. And a big change was when I brought a bottle home, and then there was like, nobody could shut me off. Nobody could tell me the bar was always open. And then it got out of control. It's like, you know, I try not to have cookies in the house. I really realized for the longest time I was looking at people that had sort of compulsive and addiction issues that I thought I was free of it. And I'm wondering if I just wasn't aware of it because I kind of grew up in a strict house where there wasn't a bunch of cookies and crap.
Yeah.
And having soda was something you did only if you went out to a restaurant, that I just wasn't able to give into it. And I don't know. Or can you just have it around the house and eventually just become addicted to it because you're doing it all the time? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I'm
once
the same.
Again, I don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
I'm definitely the same with biscuits, as we call them over here in England.
What's your go-to?
I've had to stop eating chocolate because I eat chocolate so much. So all chocolate biscuits are gone. I like ginger biscuits. That's what I like.
Well, that was my nickname in high school, so I think this is pretty good. The old ginger biscuit. I kind of go around. I've been liking the blonde Oreos lately, just okay. For something. I don't know if you have those over there.
I don't think we do. We have Oreos, but they came over fairly recently. Really, we didn't. Those were things we'd see on. There's things like Twinkies we see on American TV.
People haven't attacked it yet. They haven't said it looks too much like blackface if you turn it to the side. They're going to get rid of those cookies. Do you know over here, Elmer Fudd, I guess, got rid of his shotgun.
Right.
He's this old school hunter from the Bugs Bunny cartoon, and they didn't want him to have a gun. And you should see his gun, too. Like, it literally comes, like, the barrel, like goes out gigantic. It's like something from, like, the 1700s. The worst that he's going to influence people to get a gun or something. I don't know.
So anyway, let's talk about the film for a little bit. My favorite, you play it's interesting, isn't it? Because Pete is quite well known for his dad was a firefighter who died in 9/11, and in the film, he's got a firefighter dad who's died in a fire, you play his mum has not had any other man since the 15-20 years since that happened, and you come in as the new love interest, who's also a firefighter. It's a proper full-on acting role, right?
It's the most lines I've ever had in a movie, and it was definitely the most range of stuff, you know, a little the screaming and yelling. Obviously I've done that my whole career, but sort of, you know, having kids and trying to mentor Pete's character and the romance storyline, like I never had stuff like that before. But fortunately I got to work with people like, you know, Marissa Tomei, Steve Buscemi, Dom Lombardozzi. You know, I got to work with some real heavy hitters and then there was a lot of real firefighters on the shoot too. So they made sure, literally putting the ladder up, there's a way to put the ladder up where you look like an actor or you look like a firefighter. So they were definitely on us for all of that stuff.
Sure. My favorite scene in it is when you and Pete have a fight. And it's just like a real fight. Like, often on movies, fights aren't like real fights, but it's a proper fight in that you're both basically just pushing each other and failing really to hit each other properly. Yeah. And it's a very good comedic fight, but you hardly ever see anything like that on a film. You'll only see...
Oh, yeah. It's like the 15th round of an old school heavyweight. And for some reason, everybody knows how to move and throw. And, you know, and it's just like a real street fight is one of the ugliest things you'll ever see. You have a better chance of like blowing out your Achilles than actually connecting with a punch.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm also going for my skill set.
Have you been in fights? I know you're an angry person in your shows, but are you does that anger come
I'm really out? Not angry. No. I'm imitating angry sure. people, but people sort of like if I actually did stand up and I was angry, which I have done. If I'm just in a bad mood, my jokes don't work because the stuff that I talk about, I have to be in like a playful mood. So, and just making fun of me flipping out or something I flipped out about in the moment when I'm telling the story, I'm not actually upset, but people, they try to go like, rage fueled comedy. Like it's astounding. Like how much people don't even understand humor. Like he made fun of that. That means he doesn't care about it. It's like, or it means he cares about it so much. He doesn't want to feel those feelings. You fucking dope. So, as far as like the fighting goes, I fought up until about junior high.
Right.
And then everybody hit a growth spurt and I didn't. And I had to switch to the humor because all of a sudden teeth were getting knocked out and there was blood and shit. I mean, I fought every day with my brothers, fist fights and shit. But there's a level that your older brother's he'll stop because dad's going to come home, you know. And once we got to junior high, it was like, I'll fight you after school. There was a couple of beatdowns that they kind of took my heart where I was just like, yeah, I don't want to do that to somebody. And I certainly don't want to have that done to me. So then there was a period where I went from sticking up for myself to not sticking up for myself. So then all the work that I had created of getting respect grades 1 through 6, I then lost 6 through 8 and then paid the price in high school.
Okay. Well, it's a very funny scene. The film's great. I mean, I think Judd Apatow films for me, now that I've got kids, they're just a little bit too long. That's my only criticism of Judd Apatow films. I want them to be over in 2 hours so I can go to bed.
Well, that's the great thing about kids' movies. I just watched that Jungle Book movie with my daughter last night. And it was like 1 hour and 15 minutes. It's just like perfect.
Yeah. But we'll fall asleep.
7:15. Bed by 8:30. Perfect.
But it's very good. You're fantastic in it, and I kept forgetting it was you. Actually, to be honest, it's which I think is the real sign of when you recognize someone and know someone, and then they're so inhabited in the character they're not like the person that you associate them with, and you forget. So it's a great job. It's a very interesting.
Thank you very much. That's a very high compliment. I appreciate that.
No, it's good, man. And was it difficult for Pete to? I mean, I know he's joked about that his dad in the past, and I know that's the way he deals with it. Was that a difficult film for him to be a part of?
Yes. From what I'm gathering from his interviews, he didn't let on about it, and I didn't talk to him about it. Like I try to do the German Irish thing, like, oh, that's emotionally painful. Let's bury it and talk about something. I would be the worst therapist ever. Well, we don't want to talk about that, do we? Let's move on. It's a nice sunny day, isn't it? I do remember one of the days when we were first getting together and we were meeting the firefighters. We went to the firehouse that Pete's dad worked at.
Right.
And the one that he last worked at. And I know Pete remembered being there as a kid. And I got to tell you, one of the guys, John Sorrentino, who was working at the firehouse at the time, and fortunately was off that day on 9/11, or he would have suffered the same fate. He told us the whole story. We went downstairs and he showed us all the 9/11 photos and all the stuff. And like, I mean, dude, it was really heavy. And I was sitting there going like, man, I don't know if I'll be able to do this justice. What have I got myself into? And when we went to leave, Pete did make a comment, in a joking way of like, okay, great. And now I'm going to go home and cry. Like did it like a comedian.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, oh yeah. Hey, like I feel like I dropped the ball, to be honest with you, as a friend. I didn't know how to handle that. And, I was happy when I did an interview with him, Pete and Judd, and he was saying how he feels with this movie, he can put this stuff behind him.
Yeah.
And kind of have like his own identity, I think, with like now he's Pete Davidson, the man, as opposed to for a long time in any sort of public eye, I think he was the son of a firefighter that died on 9/11.
Yeah.
And I also think that people, for whatever reason, want to constantly bring it up. Like, he did tell me that, that people come up to him all, hey, I knew your dad. He was a great guy, blah, blah, blah. And it's just like, so it's, you just keep picking at the wound. You know yeah. what I mean? It's just like, you know what happened? It's like, if he wants, I just look at it like, I just treated it like if he wanted to bring it up and talk about it, I would.
Yeah.
But if he didn't, I wasn't going to bring it up. Why would, because why would you do that to somebody?
Sure. That's
I wouldn't do that if somebody's dog died. So do you still miss your dog? Do you find yourself excited to go for a walk and then look at that leash and realize there's nothing to connect it to? Like, why would I do that to somebody? But people, they like to do that. I don't know why they do that. You know, my wife watches a lot of shows where there's people getting interviewed crying about the most painful moments in their life. And I always tease her about it. And it's just like, oh, great. So, like, their children dying is now your entertainment for the evening? Like, how do I kill these? Like, I remember people were asking me that when that Michael Jackson documentary came out. Hey, did you see the Michael Jackson documentary? So I was like, no. Why would I want to watch that? Like, what am I going to do for tonight's entertainment? Oh, I'll smoke a joint and watch, I'll watch pedophilia testimony. I've seen every episode of The Office. I need something else to entertain me.
I feel like about that with Chernobyl. Everyone's going on about how great this Chernobyl drama is, and I don't want to watch a film about people being radioactively destroyed by a... We know what happened.
Yeah, and having deformed babies and just looking at that level of pain when there's absolutely nothing. Oh, you can be informed. And then what? I'm going to make a sign, and then the super wealthy 1% would be like, oh, look at that bald redhead with this sign. Bloodshed, people. Bloodshed affects change. Everything else, I don't know. Our economics. You got to hit them economically.
Yeah.
There you go.
Anyways, before the King of Staten Island, I'm guessing, I was trying to work out what Staten Island is in terms, in a UK term. I think Staten Island is probably like Croydon. Do you know Croydon? It's near to London.
Oh, do I know Croydon? I go way back. I used to summer there.
It's sort I've of never like, heard of it. Staten Island, I'm guessing from the film. I don't know much about Staten Island, but it's kind of near New York, but not the trashier place of, or near New York, I think. Or that's how it's viewed, I would say.
Well, let me ask you this. Yeah. It's right outside of London?
Yeah, Croydon's just outside of London.
Okay, so then all those people that move to London, okay,
yeah,
and feel that they're a success simply because they left their hometown,
sure,
and they walk past Big Ben, do they all look down on those people?
Yeah, I don't think anyone from Croydon gets out of Croydon, unfortunately, but yeah, they would do if they did that.
Oh, they do. Yeah. In New York, in Manhattan, anybody from an outer borough was considered the bridge and tunnel crowd.
Right.
It's just a super elitist, like, you know, how did you get this to the, at some point you were either in a tunnel or you went over a bridge,
yeah,
to get to this exclusive island.
Yeah.
It's stupid.
Where in London, it's if you're not on the tube network, basically, which is most of South London, but is not on the tube network, and Croydon very much is not on the tube network. So yeah, I think it's the king of Croydon. London
is, South London is where everybody thinks the animals live.
Yeah,
is that it?
Yeah, yeah.
So what was West End? I remember that song when I was a kid. Ah, the West End girls and West End guys.
The West End's
East End something in. Something, something.
The West End is the posh part of central London. It's where all the theatres are. It's where the Leicester Square Theatre, where I would be interviewing you if you were over in London.
That's the first place I played in London.
Is it? Yeah, yeah. So it's that's sort of off West End, but there's it's that area. It's Leicester Square and all that sort of area, Shaftesbury Avenue. It's supposedly swanky, but you know, it's still London.
You know what it is, Richard? You're too down to earth to even notice. You know what I mean? You're a people person.
I am.
I think it's supposedly posh. You know it is.
Yeah, but you know, Leicester Square sounds exciting, doesn't it? But it's just some cinemas and a slightly dodgy statues.
I was very excited to be there. London is a big deal for Americans.
Yeah, of course. Well, and you know, but America's a big deal for us. So the King of Staten Island.
Certain cities. certain cities. This is why I can tell, like, when our economy's not doing well, is when I hear a British accent and I'm on my way to, like, Minnesota. Where it's just like, the pound or whatever denomination you have over there is so strong over here. Let's visit states nobody in England gives a fuck about.
I went to it was sort of ended up being a holiday. Well, it's sort of a holiday, but it was because my wife's uncle was dying. So I spent 2 weeks in Warsaw, Indiana, which was a big experience. That's a side of America you don't usually see.
Well, let me ask you, is there a big Polish settlement there from back in the day that Warsaw? Because I know there's a lot of German in the Midwest, so I was wondering if
there might be. I mean, yeah, there was a lot of Amish people around there, so there was that. They'd come from you could go and visit the Amish towns and the museum, the Living Museum of the Amish. But I don't know if there was many. It was just, you know, it was proper Indiana sort of Trump. It was just before the election to 2016, I think, in the summer of that year, and a lot
right
of Trump supporters.
Right before we made it great again.
Yeah. The school playing field in over the summer was they'd covered it in crosses, and each cross represented four babies that had been aborted in the county. That was the kind of place we were going to. So it was a bit different than what as a British person you associate America with. But I was really glad.
How are you welcomed?
People were kind of surprised to see. Anyway, there's a nice lake there. It's quite a nice place. But they were very surprised that British people were there. There were some firemen there who let our daughter go on their fire truck. They were very nice. It was very nice people.
That's cool.
But they voted for Trump, so, you know. I'm
Well, he sold them a bill of goods and they bought it. Yeah. I mean, I still maintain if Bernie Sanders ran against him, because both sides wanted change and the Democrats offered more of the same. Mm-hmm. So they came up with Hillary's the classic company man, you know, give them their wars and all the shit that they want, and then it'll trickle down to us, you know. So then Trump was coming in, I'm going to drain the swamp, which was so hilarious. Like, he was going to turn the lights on and everyone was just going to be like, okay, you got us. We're corrupt. Donald's here.
Well, it's turned out to be quite, you know, it's more interesting than I even thought it would be in the way it's turned out.
There's no way anybody ever thought it was going to get to this. I almost think he has there's something psychological going on. Like, I don't even get, like, when he walked across the street and he's holding the Bible up and then has like a scowl on his face. It's like, what is that? Like, what was that? And then tweeting, just to let you know, I barricaded myself in the basement. Yeah, that's what a leader does during times of trouble.
Yeah.
Shuts the lights off. I was joking on my podcast. It was like that person on Halloween that doesn't want to participate and doesn't want to give out candy.
But see, my wife thinks he's clever and it's all a plan, and I think he's just, you know, floundering through. I think generally, I know you're into conspiracy theories, so you think things are controlled by
this guy. If this whole pretending to be psychologically unstable is a ploy to get a second term,
yeah,
it is one of the greatest things you've ever seen to show people. Like, I want to get reelected again. My game plan is to show that I'm psychologically unstable. And if that works, because I'll tell you this, when they brought him in for that roast, that Obama roast, the Seth Meyers thing, and they stuck him in the middle of the room like raw meat for the absolute height of embarrassment and humiliation. And he sat there and they all joked about how being president was way more difficult than the issues. And Obama, just his delivery was just crushed the guy.
Yeah.
The fact that the guy then, 2 years later, the president has to turn his house over to him was like, that was like a Hollywood movie.
Yeah.
As far as, like, that was like Carrie, where they dumped the blood on him And then he came back and he got his revenge.
But that was also the 100% the moment he decided, because all he's done is to turn back everything that Obama's done. So he just decided in that moment, I'm going to become president. I'm going to get back at you for this. And I'm just going to, all I'm going to do is just do the opposite of what you did.
Very vindictive.
Yeah.
He's not a guy. I shouldn't be even saying that. He's not a guy that I would want to be upset with me.
No, when I, you know.
But this should be. This should be interesting. Like, just two of the oldest white guys we have over here are going to start yelling at each other during a debate. So I can't wait.
It's fun. It's fun for comedians, as long as we, you know, as you say, as long as they don't start.
I'm calling it the dud versus the dope. We're going to see what happens.
So I want to talk.
I'm still holding out that you know the left will give Bernie Sanders a chance, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It'd be nice to put someone like just slightly younger in, I think. Just someone who's under 60 would be good. Just give them a chance. Give a youngster a chance.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I wanted to talk to you about sex robots because that is, again, something we have in common in our stand-up. I did a big routine about sex robots, and you did a big routine about sex robots.
Oh, I did. I watched yours, and I stole it word for word, man.
Yeah, you and Banksy.
Came onto your podcast to apologize.
It's a very different it's a different take on it, but I'm equally fascinated by sex robots. Mine came out of the fact that there was a program about, you know, super realistic robots, and I had an argument with my wife about whether it's cheating. If I was to have sex with a robot, is that cheating on my wife? Do you think that having sex with a robot is allowed within a marriage, or do you think that should be considered cheating?
It depends on what model you get.
Yeah.
I would think, like, how good the technology is.
Well, it would be
I mean, if it's basically like fucking a pillow with a head on it, then I think you have other issues. But if it's really, like, human-like...
Yeah.
I can tell you this, that is something I want to believe that I'm never going to do because I don't think you return from that level of freedom where it's like, you're just going to have somebody that's not going to question you.
Yeah.
Cause it's going to go beyond that. Once people start banging them, then they're going to want to have the full on relationship. Like, hey man, you know, I've been fucking you any way I wanted to for the last couple of months. I figured I'd take you out on a picnic at least, as long as it doesn't rain so you won't rust out here, right? And I think eventually it's going to move in that direction, and it's going to be and then there's going to be progressive people saying that these robots deserve rights,
yeah,
and that these robots should be allowed to come in and say goodbye to their human partner when they're on their deathbed. It's going to be it's going to be. And things are going to get worse before they get better.
Okay.
When it comes
to... I'm very hopeful. I think it's going to be good.
It's already too late. It's already too late. The Pandora's box has been opened. No, we did a All Things Comedy. We produced a special for Whitney Cummings. And her is a joke. She had a robot sex doll made in her likeness.
Okay.
And I was told when they were visiting different factories to see which one. They went to one creepy one they didn't want to go to where they had all these little ones. And they were like, what are those? And then they said that those are the economy size ones. When it was clearly like it looked like it was like a little kid.
Yeah.
So that is just not I the fact that nobody like the level of attention on a stand-up comedian's joke while this shit is being developed just right over here. There's no, I don't know, part of me just thinks there's such little manufacturing done in the United States that they legalized weed and robot sex dolls just so we could have something that said made in America. Steinway & Sons pianos. There's a few things left.
Yeah, well, it would be, you know, there is, there's a big philosophical question at the heart of it about whether the human race will continue. It's exactly what you said, whether you, you know, no. Whether you would need that, whether you would want a relationship with something that was completely would bend to your will, whatever that was. You know, in a human relationship, we have to, you know, make concessions and have arguments.
You have to work on yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think it plays out.
Yeah.
I think the upper 1%, you know, sort of a hacky term, but I would say the super rich.
Yeah.
One of the most annoying things about other human beings to them is our complaining. How many hours we're working, we want health insurance, we want benefits, we want to be treated like a human being and all that. These robots solve this. So basically what they could do is replace the entire workforce with literally slave labor. And then on top of that, it would be all these supermodel looking slave labor that they could then fuck anyone that they wanted to.
Yeah.
And then I feel like it just becomes like seven royal families in each country and all robot slash worker and sex slaves.
No more human beings than that. So all the poor people would go and all the people who weren't.
They all go.
All gone.
Yeah. The only reason why they keep us around is they need us.
Yeah.
Once you have that, you make a couple of funny robots, then I'm out of there. You know, you get your funny robot, yeah. You get your sex robot, you get your strong robot. And then, but you'd have to keep some people around to do maintenance, but eventually they would teach the robots how to fix each other.
Yeah.
And, but you would need like the geek squad to still be around to make sure that they didn't turn on them. They're going to have a tiger by the tail.
Yeah.
What's going to happen. So I think that eventually there's going to be this weird period where regular people are just going to kind of be sitting around and there's going to be no job. And we're going to be like the old VCR when the DVD player came out, you know, and you just put the DVD player on top of the VCR.
Yeah.
That's going to be us.
Yeah. But I mean, I think that's an optimistic look at it. I think that could very well be. I wanted to ask you about the paper tiger. This is just a very specific prop based thing in Paper Tiger. I noticed that, and this is only in this is the one you did at the Albert Hall. Was that Paper Tiger? You had a head mop. You had like a big sponge thing that you mopped your head with when you got sweaty. Do you know what I'm talking about? It looked like a kind of mop. It looked like a mop thing, but you didn't have it in any of the other stand-up routines that I saw. Was it particularly hot in that venue, or was that something that you have a
it
towel?
It was a hand towel.
Was it? It looked like a mop thing, like a little hat, beanie hat thing that you do.
Ask you a question. Yeah. How old is your television?
It's new. It looked. I guess it had just been sat on a chair, and you picked it up and went. But I noticed you didn't mop your head in. And the other stand-up specials I watched, so...
Yeah, and then what ends up becoming a problem is if you sweated a little more in the first one than the second one.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I've learned through time to, like, sort of remember where the mic stand. It's this weird thing where you have to remember where things are while also just being carefree and sort of loose. Because I usually take like 90% of one special,
right,
is what I do. And then there's just a few, because if they're like too long, like the Royal Albert Hall one was too long, so we had to cut a little section out.
Yeah.
Slam it together. So then you kind of need, it's almost like, you know, when people restore a car, they have the car they want to restore and then they buy another version and that's the parts car.
Yeah.
You kind of need that to take a couple of things to put it on and make it. So that's why I had the mop thing.
Head mop. I just wondered if that was a thing you developed over the, I've got hair, so I don't need a head mop. I've got a lot of hair. So that hair just, that gets rid of the head sweat itself.
You have no idea how much, like the level that you have to sweat.
Yeah.
Before you look down and it starts pouring, before you shave your head, it's unreal.
Right.
Like, I mean, if I was to go do a hot yoga class, I would need like a headband. Because it would be just coming down in my eyes and it would start stinging.
How was playing the Albert Hall? I've not played the Albert Hall at all, I don't think. But was that, it's quite an unusual venue.
You don't think. You would forget that? Like, I want to live your life. Like, what life are you living that you play Royal? Did I ever play that place?
I haven't. You sometimes do charity concerts somewhere and do like 5 minutes somewhere. But I don't think I've
that's
done.
That's right. And I don't count those.
No.
You don't count those.
No, but I've never even got to play the rooms. I played, there's a little room at the Albert Hall that seats about 200 people. I've played that. But I've not played the actual Albert Hall. I've been there and watched stuff. It's quite a weird venue for comedy, I would think. Did it just because it's a high ceiling, the audience are...
Oh, I loved it.
Did you?
Yeah, I'm a huge Led Zeppelin fan. Right. So every time I go there, I just picture John Bonham's drums are right there.
Yeah.
Page was there. John Paul Jones Plant was there, you know. I absolutely... I love performing there. It was an unbelievable honor to go to another country just to have people show up, forget about playing. I mean, that's one of the most beautiful venues in the world.
Sure.
I don't know if you take it for granted because you live down the street. You're not sure if West End is posh or not.
The Albert Hall's pretty posh.
You can't remember if you played the Royal Albert Hall or not. Like, it's sort of a big deal for an American to go over there.
I played I can't even remember what it's called. There's a tiny room. Yeah, I haven't played the Albert Hall, but I would like to. It looks nice.
Carnegie Hall. I can't remember if I was ever there. Is that in Rhode Island?
So let's quickly talk about... I mean, there's loads more to talk about. This is, but let's talk about F is for Family, which is the fourth season's just about to go out on Netflix in the next few days. Yes, I think.
That also comes out Friday, okay. June 12th.
It's a big day for you. It's a big day for your fans.
And then I got nothing. And then it's all, I flatline.
It's, again, it's unusual in that it's a cartoon, but it feels, I mean, it's comedy, but it feels very dramatic to me again. I think, like, the more you get into the story of it, there's big series arcs, and it's about the relationships of the people. So it's not like The Simpsons, or maybe it's like The Simpsons in the early days where it was about the family relationships, but it's actually a darker thing than most cartoons. Do you think
yeah.
fair to say?
I would say that. Sorry, I got to turn the pillow over. It's getting hot in my legs, my old legs here, my 52-year-old thighs. The comedy, I like all kinds of comedy. Sure. I like absurd. I like silly, avant-garde. I don't care what it is. But like just my wheelhouse from where my brain is, I like coming from a place of reality. And it can get absurd, but I try not to go too absurd. We sort of pick our spots of absurdity on the show, but it has to be tethered to some sort of reality.
Yeah.
And that's just my own personal taste, because if when stuff gets so ridiculously absurd, I stop caring about the characters.
Sure.
Like, I don't give a shit what happens to any of them. And so I need to have some sort of something that I can kind of relate to. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just in the opening titles of your character flying through the sky from a young man to a middle-aged man and crashing through the roof into his family, just the way... that opening titles passes by, you kind of know It sort of sat funny and just, oh my God, that's our lives, isn't it? That's our lives gone. In an instant, we fly and the hope disappears from his eyes and you're stuck with this angry middle-aged guy, which I know isn't based solely on your experience. I know that you've got a lot of writers there and you've created a sort of composite of all your fathers and mothers, maybe a little bit. Is that true?
Yeah, that's actually what I like most about the show. I like that it isn't any one specific person's family member, because I don't think that's a fair thing to do to somebody, especially if they're not in show business or anything like that. I guess if you're in show business, somebody can do a send up of you, but that's in a way your fault for standing on a stage. That's part of it. But if somebody, you know, I didn't want anybody that I knew or loved to be mortified by it, but I definitely, you know, will take bits and pieces of stories or an event or a line that somebody said, like, I'll put you through that fucking wall, was something my dad used to say.
Yeah.
And one time he did say that when we were standing outside, and he sort of pointed towards like the yard. I'll put you through that for like, what, the wall across the street, that other house or whatever. We try not to laugh. Just things like that were sort of the basis of, the show actually came about for me telling stories about my family on stage. And I've been doing this long enough that I've seen sort of like generations go by where my family stories were totally relatable and hilarious at first. And then all of a sudden, after 15 years in, it was kind of like, oh, and they started some groan. Then everything got labeled. That's mental abuse, physical abuse. That's overbearing behavior. And I'd be on stage like, come on, this is funny. So I got frustrated. I wish I could shut that stupid friggin' dinging thing off. I don't know how to do it. But I just got frustrated with it. And I was trying to think, how the hell could I ever tell these stories and without people getting offended? And then, you know, I was a fan of South Park and a lot of these shows like that and the stuff that they could get away with. I was like, all right, what if I animate them? So I was just going to do little 5-minute vignettes. I was going to pay to animate them on my website. And I never got around to it. And then fortunately, through this comedian, Steve Byrne, I met Vince Vaughn and Peter Billingsley, and they had a production company, Wild West Productions. And through them, I met Mike Price, the great Mike Price, who's our showrunner and who's from The Simpsons. And then it became a show.
Yeah.
Turned into a half hour thing. And then we went to Netflix and we wanted to do standalone episodes. And Netflix was like, no, do it serialized. One episode leads into the other. And I thought that that was the dumbest idea. Why would you do that? And then within 10 minutes of starting to write like that, I realized, no, this is brilliant. And it was so much fun. And thank God Netflix gave that note, because I didn't know what the hell I was doing.
No, it's very rare you get a note from above that makes things something better. But I think that sending that first series season especially, I think just you're getting into it and then you get very caught up in the story, the strike, the airstrike.
You know what's funny? The only thing worse than a bad note is a good note. A bad note. What the hell? They don't even get the show. A good note, then you feel stupid. Like, yeah they're right. How come we didn't see that?
But what I think what you read, because it's set in 1973, which is obviously like a little bit earlier than you would have been 10 years. There's a character that I sort of feel is you as a kid, right? That's called Bill. But you wouldn't have been 10 in 73. But I think the look, especially the peripheral characters, They're very 70s without being cliches. I really like the little kid with the hair all over his face and the guys who work in the airport. The actual look of the animation is fantastic, I think.
Yeah, you know, a lot of TV and movies sort of turn every decade into a cartoon.
Yeah.
Like whatever the fad was, they make it look like everybody was into it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then also everybody has a new car. If it takes place in the 70s, everybody's driving a car from the 70s. Like there's no cars left over from the 60s or the 50s. Like Frank drives a 1965 four-door Ford Galaxy. Yeah. 1973, it's about 8 years old. That's what a married guy with three kids would be driving.
Yeah.
Sue drove a late 60s, early 70s Country Squire station wagon that she has since cracked up. And then they had to buy like a 74 wagon. And that was like a big deal. Like I remember there was a guy in our neighborhood. There was always like one guy in the neighborhood who had some big, like he was a businessman and he went on business trips, which was like a big deal. Like somebody went to the airport and flew somewhere. And he also had a company car. every 2 years he'd get a new, and we all lived vicariously off him.
Right.
And this guy across the street always had a brand new Lincoln Continental. He was an executive, and he'd get a brand new Lincoln Continental every 2 years. What color was it going to be? What was it going to look like? It was amazing. And he was sort of in a suit way, business way, was like a rock star in my neighborhood. So we tried to have it like, you know, in our country, my country, it was like, it was a huge economic downturn in the 70s. And a lot of corporations' responses to unions that had then become oppressive the way they had.
Yeah.
You know, like, hey, it's not my job. You know, it's my time to lean on this shovel. You need to hire five guys to go up this ladder and change this sign and pay us all $20 an hour. Like, they really were throwing their weight around, and corporations are like, all right, fuck you. We're leaving the country.
Yeah.
So have fun with your union. And all of these jobs, steel worker jobs and all of that, went away. And inner cities became like where they were these big, robust places of employment, just became like the Rust Belt.
Sure.
So the 70s, you know, gas guzzling cars, you know, factories going out of work, out of business, old theaters broken down. Like the theaters were used to be like these places you dressed in suits to see movies and vaudeville, then movies. And then they kind of became like porno adult movie houses by the 60s and 70s. So it was a really... it was kind of a grimy time.
Sure.
With this super colorful serial and TV shows and acid and stuff. But like Hollywood just kind of focused on like the AMC Pacer, lava lamps, bell bottoms. Like for some reason, the Serpico 70s never existed in Hollywood. It was all the Bee Gees disco, big collars and that type of shit. They kind of skipped over where our show exists.
Yeah, well,
and I remember the Beatles and shit, and people didn't walk down the street in that John Travolta, you know, all white suit with the black shirt. Like people didn't walk around in that, you know.
I think both the film and the series are both they're about people that you don't usually see in TV shows and films, or not as much. So it's blue collar in America, isn't it? But it's so interesting, I think, to see that done from a, like you say, from a realistic and a perspective of people who actually experienced it. And that car thing is great detail. It's really where people have really thought about it. The new series is I won't go into too much detail because it's just coming out. I don't want to spoil it for people, but Jonathan Banks from Breaking Bad is playing your character's dad, who's sort of interestingly in your character's memory is this ball-breaking, horrible guy, but everyone else thinks he's a legend and has a different memory of him, and he seems nice when he comes back.
Yeah, we were sort of playing with that idea of, like, you know how your parents, you know, when you sit down around the holidays and, you know, you have a couple of drinks, like, you know, one time you did this and blah, 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 and their perception of it, 90% of the times, first of all, they're like, oh, I never did that. That never happened. Or it was just a joke. And what I've realized over the years is like it was just a joke to them. But to you and your child brain, you, like they hit you at an adult level when you were a kid. So it actually nobody's wrong.
Yeah.
Because they were joking, but it did damage you. And it becomes this thing in your head because your world is so small. That event is so big and so vivid and really like can define you or change you as a person. And then when you bring it up to them 30 years later, it was so minuscule, they don't even remember it.
Yeah, of course.
Which actually adds to the pain.
Yeah.
Like, I was your son and you did that and you don't even remember? And they're like, that didn't even happen, you know? So, and then what happens is all the person that you marry meets your dad as an adult and like, oh, he's a great guy. He's a great, like they just, and you so want them to see them the way you see them. So then you kind of have to wrestle with this thing of like, did I make too big a deal out of this?
Yeah.
Or have I held on to this too long? Am I insane? Or am I right? And my wife is just more of the same like my dad and I'm never going to get validated. So you have to like wrestle with all of that. So a lot of the season is about that.
Yeah, it's right. It's, you know, I think anything, parents and children, fathers and sons, it's always like there's always a lot to get to get out of those things. But I get, you know, I don't know. It's also, you sort of hit, I mean, I don't know, our lives compared to our father's lives, you know, I think certainly your dad was a dentist, my dad was a headmaster. It's the lives we have are sort of would be unimaginable. To my granddad, the life I have would be unimaginable. But they, you know, he lived, my granddad lived a life where he was just, working in the building trade, that sort of thing. He could never, yeah. You know, he was a clever guy, but he could never have broken away and gone to university or done something like become a comedian. You know, it would have been absolutely impossible.
Yeah, I have a little bit of both. I have some blue collar people that started their own businesses,
yeah,
and became big fish in little ponds out there. I had another relative that was a big time executive.
Right.
I feel like this is where I kind of get that comedic streak. He was a big executive at one of the big three car companies in Detroit.
Okay.
And he shot his mouth off about something. He should have kept his mouth shut and not said what he was thinking, but he did. Then he got busted all the way down to like running a car dealership. So there's a little bit of Frank Murphy in that.
Yeah.
In that, like, where Frank never got there. This guy got there and then kind of got busted down. But he also, you know, I think kind of taught people in my family to say what you're thinking. If you really think it's right to say it, you know, consequences be damned. So I've seen a lot of that in my family where there is a, it should be said, but you shouldn't say it. And then you do, and then you pay the price. Or, because I don't want to paint it like we're always right, because we aren't. But then there's the other thing of like, there's times where we are right, but the way we express it, we then become wrong, which has been my life. We're like, yeah, dude, you made a good point, but that's no reason to call somebody a fucking cunt. You could have just made the point rather than leading with, let me tell you something, you fucking cunt. Because who is listening after that?
True.
You know?
But, you know,
like a big phrase in my family is, you know what your fucking problem is? Which, like, somebody's going to be like, well, gee, I've been waiting for somebody to tell me what my problem is. By all means, bestow your wisdom on me.
It's the problem with the world, though, isn't it? That's if everyone started, look, what about this, rather than you fucking...
No, that's my favorite.
Yeah.
That's my favorite thing when I look at interactions on the internet, where people were right, like, hey, fuckhead, maybe if you blah, blah, blah. Like, who's listening past, hey, fuckhead? It's over.
It's true. But, you know, expressing yourself, I think maybe it's something that, you know, I'm writing a book at the moment about men and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's about, well, I do this thing on international.
I love how you soft pedal all your stuff. That's about men and blah, blah, blah. I maybe played the Royal Albert Hall. I don't remember.
It's about where men are at the moment based on, you know, I do a thing on International Women's Day where I go on Twitter and everyone who asks when's International Men's Day, when there'll never be an International Men's Day, and there is an International Men's Day. It's November the 19th. So I just find everyone who asks that question and tell them it's November the 19th.
That's great. That's hilarious. Because I would have thought the response you were going to get every other day of the year.
When you get that, that's the other cliche. But it's just, it's a bad, you know, it's like people doing their bit of stand-up on Twitter. Go, when's International Men's Day? November the 19th. It's not a good joke is my main problem with it. But I'm ending up writing a book about whether, you know, equality and whether, you know, men or women need it more or blah, blah, blah. But I think men are in a sort of crisis. I'm quoting you with them. I've quoted you in a chapter because I was talking about the male feminists and how ridiculous you think that is, that a man can be a feminist. But that's also the view of feminists. Like, feminists don't want men to be feminists.
Not that they're a feminist. I just view it as they're just putting on that
sure
thing to keep, to be like, see, I wore my button.
Yeah, yeah.
Male feminist. Gonna be, oh, he's an ally. And all that, those dumb terms. It's like, that's all you have to do? That's all you have to do. So all those Nazis at the end of World War II, all they would have to do is just put on a button. I mean, come on. It's just like your actions, I think, should prove, like, I don't know. I have a debate with this. My wife is also like, well, yeah, but a button is a show and a sign of solidarity. She's also right. I'm an idiot.
No, but I mean, I think... I think you're both. You're right and wrong, and we're all right and wrong. It's a very difficult book to write because I want to get both sides, but I also want to.
That's exactly right. We are all right and wrong.
Yeah, and so it's very difficult.
Of human beings is our inability to admit when we're wrong, yeah. And I have it in spades.
Yeah, but I think men are, you know, there is a crisis that men don't express themselves. Like comedians, you know, at least even if you're expressing yourself in fake anger, or comedians express themselves, and though a lot of comedians are crazy, it's good to get it out there, right? It makes me feel better to do the sort of stuff I do on stage. I'm sure it makes you feel better to get that stuff out. I think a lot of men are repressing, and because of masculinity, which again, I suppose both of these things we're talking about, these new projects are about masculinity and about the journey men have to take, and the way that men can equally be downtrodden by the system. But men get angry with women when they should be getting angry with the system. The same system that's stamping women down is stamping men down. You know, it's the patriarchy's bad for men, and yet we support it much more than women do, because we kind of buy into that masculine stuff.
We don't question it.
Yeah.
You don't sort of like that whole thing that we support it, like there's some sort of meeting going on. I don't know. I will tell you, I'm watching a show right now that's based on a real murder case.
Right.
And it's about a woman. She was raised Catholic. She believed in marriage. Gets married to this guy. The guy's in medical school. All right. And, you know, which is obviously a lot of debt you incur before he becomes a doctor. So right as he gets to the end of medical school, he decides he doesn't want to be a doctor. He wants to be a lawyer, and do like malpractice suits, lawsuits. So he goes to law school, and during that time, she was the breadwinner and supported him. But then they finally come out the other side. He makes partner. He's making all this money, and they're living the good life. And then he starts, you know, hooking up with some assistant, has an affair, and ends up leaving his wife for her. Long story short, she snaps, drives her car into the front of his house, into the front door, with her own kids in there.
Right.
And eventually she ends up getting a gun and killing both of them.
Okay.
And when I read about the actual case, said this was a landmark case that opened up the debate about women sacrificing their careers to help their guys and then being left with nothing. And I just thought that was the funniest thing ever. That it was like, this was the case that brought that up? Like, this isn't a case about mental illness and maybe gun control. It's like, there's no way if a guy murdered his wife that it would be a landmark case to talk about how the problems that men have with something that women are doing in a case where a guy murdered a woman.
Yeah.
Like O.J. Simpson. This is a great case. This is a landmark case that brought up the fact that wives don't rub their guys' feet enough after a long day. Out there on the gridiron, like you would be tarred and feathered, and it would be the end of your career. And like, and I'm watching the way they're telling the story. I love the show because the acting's incredible. The writing is good, but the way they are making the husband out in this marriage, when I'm watching it, is I am like three episodes in. I'm like, oh yeah, she should shoot this guy. Like, this is the way. And this was an actual guy who can't defend himself and is dead. And his kids are psychologically scarred because of what the ex-wife did. And you're watching it, and the way that they're telling the story, because I've gotten an argument with my wife about it. I go, do you don't think this is weird? The way they're telling this story? And he goes, well, it's her story. It's like, what, did she write it? There's a difference between being her story and being a story about what she did.
Sure.
This almost seems like it's a defense. Recently, she's been in jail for like 30 years, and recently she was up for parole, and she has some sort of narcissistic defect or whatever. She still sees nothing wrong with what she did.
Okay.
And they won't let her out. I mean, she's an absolute nut job.
Yeah.
I mean, whether she's in a mental health facility, I think, is the debate.
Yeah.
And how to just... You know, listen, what that guy did was bad. It was a piece of shit move. You get divorced. That's it. It's not licensed to go murder the guy. But the way they're telling this story, that is the thing where a lot of my comedy comes from. where it's just so blatantly like we had one football player that was taking a knee over here.
Yeah.
All right. About police brutality. And everybody on the left was like, hey, man, like, you know, let him say what he wants to say. And everybody on the right was like, shut the fuck up and play football. And now another football player is talking about Black Lives Matter, you know, kind of arguing it. And then all of a sudden the right's like, hey, man, let him say what he wants. Then the left's like, oh, you shut the fuck up. We need to cancel you. So the whole thing is just.
Yeah.
It's just bizarre. The whole thing is bizarre. But I find with like that. That men, woman thing, like for as much as they're complaining, there's like some really like major issues, like, I don't know, murder.
Yeah.
Where the dialogue is still going in the direction of these poor women.
Yeah. I mean,
I am 100% in agreement, Richard, that if a woman puts her career aside and then this guy gets all these credits and then he leaves, she is entitled to something. But I draw the line that she's entitled to go murder him and his sure. new wife. That make me like a misogynistic person?
I don't. I guess not. I haven't seen the show, so I can't massively comment. I would only say that I guess it's, you know, women have experienced it a lot more, I guess, in the other direction. And I suppose I think you're right. There's a real life. There's a drama. There's a vicarious thrill, like in Breaking Bad, there's a vicarious thrill about
here.
That guy.
I might be weird here. I might be weird here where I think if a wife kills a husband or the husband kills a wife, they are equally
sure.
terrible people
yeah.
and need to go to jail unless there was some sort of physical abuse sure. by the guy when the woman didn't feel she had. That I understand.
Mm-hmm.
All right, but whatever. The guy screws around and then leaves you. Then, I mean, that definitely sucks.
Yeah.
Get a lawyer. Be an adult.
Very good. Right. Well, I should let you go in a sec. We haven't even talked about podcasting and how you've managed to turn this thing into you basically turn podcasting into a huge, you've got your own studios and your own production company and you're making shows for.
I did it with Al Madrigal, Mike yeah. Bertolini, a bunch of other guys helped me out, and Bert Kreischer, everybody, you know, that has been podcasting on it. It's like, we just, you know, throughout my career, I've just watched artists create a scene and then the businessman comes in like, okay, this is how we're going to make money off of it, which is great because you need the businessman. But it always ends up being, okay, I own all of it. All the checks come to me and then I pay you with my name on the check. And then they just steal from you. And then they're making mailbox money.
Yeah.
And you have to keep dancing for your supper. So we wanted to create something where comedians could all band together, help each other out, and still maintain ownership of their podcasts and their projects. Yeah. And that's what we've been doing.
That's great. When you started podcasting in 2007, were you getting a lot of comics saying to you, what the fuck are you doing this? You're not making any money out of this. Why would you podcast? Or did you immediately hit the ground?
It was just totally looked at as a promotional thing.
Right.
It was. I actually called in a service on my flip phone cell phone and would only talk for 5-6 minutes and then promote my upcoming gigs.
Yeah.
And then I would put it on my MySpace page.
Right.
Those were the first episodes. And I used to drive around and I'd be in airports making fun of fat people and shit. Like, those were the first ones. They were like 5 minutes and they were 10 minutes, 15, 20 minutes. And then it just sort of grew into a show. And people just started listening. And once enough people listen, then the advertisers start sniffing around. And yeah, and then all of a sudden you get a guy like Joe Rogan and Mark Maron having the standing president as a guest. It's crazy.
Yeah. No, it's been, it is that sort of appeal to me as well. That sort of, you know, having the autonomy to do whatever you wanted. I think, again, it kept in the UK 10 years ago, 12 years ago, we were going through like one of those times where radio and TV were saying, you can't do this, you can't say that. So just the idea of being able to do whatever you wanted and put it straight out there was what sort of appealed to me. But it's incredible. I think the last 5 or 10 years how it has become such a big business, obviously in America especially, there's multi-million dollar deals.
Yeah, it's been
yeah
it's been crazy. been crazy. So I'm happy to be a small part of it.
but you're a pretty big part of it. Well, look, I should let you go. You've been fantastic to give us all this time. Coming out very soon, probably by the time this podcast did, F is for Family and The King of Staten Island, both fantastic, very well worth your time. You're also, we didn't even talk about The Mandalorian. I'm not that interested in Star Wars, but I'm still impressed by The Mandalorian.
I didn't watch it much either. No. All I would do is make fun of it. People actually think I hate Star Wars. Like, I haven't even watched it enough to have an opinion on it. But I just would, anytime I see people getting overly excited about something, as a comedian, the antenna goes up. It's like, there's something to make fun of, because it will annoy those people, but will make these people over here laugh. It's sort of a form of trolling. So I've definitely had a lot of people asking me, like, hey, this is something you made fun of, and now all of a sudden you're in it. John Favreau came up to me. We were at a mutual friend's birthday party, and because I'm in the mix out here, Richard.
Yeah, you know? Pretty clearly.
He asked me if I wanted to be on it, and I told him, I said, you know, I've done nothing but make fun of that. He goes, I know, I listened to your podcast. I think your fans would think it would be hilarious if you were in it. Now, had I known that he was going to shoot it like a spaghetti Western, and I used to love all the Clint Eastwood, Charles Bronson, Lee Marvin movies, if I knew it was going to be, I would have begged him to be in it. So it was just sort of dumb luck.
Yeah.
Of getting to know a few different people and doing a podcast. That's how I got on it.
Well, it's great to see. I mean, I think a lot, comedians are good actors on the whole, a lot. And it's interesting, the ones that go and do it, but you're extremely, and Breaking Bad as well, obviously. I mean, it's a lot of the, isn't for you're in probably four episodes of that, but that's a very memorable character of QB, was it? as he says, as he tries to remember, but I got it right, so that's good. The line on the money, and it's the scene where the guy runs into the wall, tries to escape and runs into the wall. It's the very memorable bits. To be playing with, I mean, all these things, you know, Marissa Tomei, what a fantastic actor to work with, and Jonathan Banks you've been working with, and you've been in a scene with Walter White and Mike in Breaking Bad. That's pretty good.
I know. No, one of the coolest things was, because I was such a big fan of the show.
Sure.
When I actually got on it, I was pinching myself. But one of the coolest things was I got to do a scene in Saul Goodman's office.
Yeah.
We had the Constitution on the wall, and I think he went into the safe, and I was just like, I can't believe. Because I didn't get on to like the fourth season, I think. So sure. I had been, and at that point I'd watched like, you know, 60 episodes of this thing or whatever it was, and 30, 40 episodes of it. It was so surreal to be. I imagine for a Star Wars fan, that was like my Millennium Falcon.
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah.
How about that?
Yeah, that's cool. Well, look, I'll let you get back to your tiny child. They're so little when they come out, and you forget how tiny they are. It's so nice that first.
Oh, yeah.
That first
and how soft they just like, they're like a horse's muzzle.
I mean, I kind
the
of
best smell ever.
I mean, I don't want to have another
yawn,
one. But
if you make the heart explode,
yeah,
with love, just watching them yawn, it's the cutest thing ever. Not that I haven't enjoyed talking to you, Richard, but I'm going to get back to that.
You get back to that. They grow up and they're not as nice. But I kind of think, oh, maybe we'll have another one now. I can't do it.
Yeah, you can't put your wife through that again.
poor woman. Hey, look, thanks so much for giving me so much of your time. And everyone go and stream both of those shows, and the film and the shows. It's very well worth your time. Thank you very much. I hope to see you over
in
the UK soon.
I'll see you in the West End, all right?
Yeah, I'll see you in the West End. Thanks so much, Phil. Bye, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much. Cheers,
thank
dude.
You, everybody. We'll see you.
Bye.
Richard, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was awesome. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right, we'll see.
I'll just... You have been listening to Rahalastapa with me, Rich Herring, and my guest, Bill Burr. Thank you very much to Pest for continuing to provide us with these musical treats. I would like to thank very much Chris Evans, not that one, or that one. Oh, I think of the other ones. He's the Welsh one from Welsh Wales. Taffy McTaffy, T-Taff, they call him. And he has been invaluable help during this lockdown period, setting up all this stuff and being there for me when things have gone wrong and making sure the guests turn up, as they nearly didn't this week. I'm indebted probably to some executive producer, but I don't have their name this time. They'll be in next week's instead.
Thank you very much to Ben Walker and everyone else who knows me. And thank you to everyone at Acast, British Comic Guide, Ian Tunes, all that lot. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStripe.com production. Go to GoFasterStripe.com/badges for more stuff than you could dream would possibly be and to help us make more podcasts. You'll get lots of lovely extras, my fan friends.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to Amazon.com/comedy ad free. That's Amazon.com/comedy ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can and make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.